And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, here's today's final Jeopardy question. What do Wordsworth, Rachel Carson, John Muir, E.F. Schumacher, Aldo Leopold, Teddy Goldsmith, Gerald Durrell, and Terry Tempest Williams have in common? And here's the answer to today's final Jeopardy question. Who are some of the world's leading nature and environmental writers? Ever wanted to be a nature writer? You'll find out what it takes when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Nature and the environment are in the news. Whether it be stampeding elephants in India, the drought in the American Southeast, mountaintop removal protecting turtle eggs on Mexico's shoreline, and we won't even mention global warming, clean energy, ocean bottom trawling, new Chinese coal plants. Nature is the emerging big story on the planet. And what's needed right now are lots and lots of new writers to tell the stories. Today, we talk with Wendy Holtkamp, a working nature and environmental writer and journalist who shares some basic knowledge on what's involved in getting your stories published. We'll be talking with her in segment two, following a special news. In segment one, this segment, we bring you the weekly Earth Summit and then get an update from Donna Buckby, who has been feeding us reports from Rushford, Minnesota, about the recovery efforts underway in the small Midwestern town that was severely flooded just 2 months ago. With homes and businesses destroyed and winter coming on, how are things coming along? You'll find out. But first, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. We begin today's summit with some good news from Carl Pope, president of the Sierra Club. Carl?
For decades, American Electric Power and other utilities broke the law. They refused to install pollution control equipment required by the Clean Air Act. So in 1999, the Sierra Club sued AEP, charging it had failed to modernize 46 coal-fired power units, mostly in the Ohio Valley, including three of America's dirtiest power plants. The Bush administration tried to bail AEP out with its misnamed Clear Skies rule that would have legalized the failure to clean up. When Congress said no, the case was set for trial, consolidated with other cases filed by states, environmental groups, even the Justice Department. This month, AEP admitted it had broken the law. It agreed to spend $4.6 billion cleaning up. This is good news for air quality in the Midwest and Northeast. Millions of pounds of pollutants will be kept out of the air. But it's also a reminder, without a tough environmental cop on the beat, there will always be companies that break the law to save money.
Thank you, Carl. Our next guest is Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who reminds us of the importance of wild waters. Dr. Lovejoy?
One of the interesting things that really needs to be redressed is the way we think of parts of this living planet as inanimate. You know, we think of water as something that basically comes out of a faucet or runs down a river. We don't really think about fresh water as home to a whole variety of living things that only make their living in fresh water, whether it be some of the magnificent mayfly larvae, which build little castles of different things, or it's fish, or it's mollusks, or whatever it may be. And similarly, we tend to think of soil as inert. In fact, we call it dirt. But in fact, soil is a living system. It's filled with all kinds of living organisms, basically, which are helping recycle critical nutrients and make them available to living things once again. So it's time we sort of woke up and looked at all of this planet as being a living system and one we should respect.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. David Foreman has written to and spoken up on behalf of our generation and others yet to come. He is particularly focused on reestablishing viable wild corridors in North America to preserve the diversity of our natural world. Dave?
Most Americans, when they hear the name United States Fish and Wildlife Service, would logically think that it's an agency designed to protect animals, and in some cases they're right. However, for much of its history, the Fish and Wildlife Service's main mission has been to kill animals, and particularly predators and other troublesome species like prairie dogs. During the first half of the 20th century, the Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an extermination campaign to get rid of predators such as wolves, mountain lions, and grizzly bears from the lower 48 states. But in the 1980s and 1990s, with the turnaround in public attitude towards large carnivores, the Fish and Wildlife Service led the effort to recover wolves in the western United States, the wolves indeed that it once killed. And this led to the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park in 1995. And in Arizona and New Mexico in 1997, the reintroduction in the wild of the lobo, the Mexican wolf, the most endangered carnivore in the world. Dave Parsons, now of the Rewilding Institute, led this effort as the team leader for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But now, under the political commissars of the Bush administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has turned to its old ways and is leading a second extinction campaign of lobos in the wild, doing this for a handful of public land ranchers. Right now, violating all the recommendations from conservation biologists and others and their former guidelines, the Fish and Wildlife Service, lack of management, lack of protection, willingness to kill the endangered lobos in the wild if they so much as look at a cow, is leading rapidly to their extermination in the wild. If India mismanaged its tigers in the reprehensible way the United States is managing its lobos, the world would be outraged. If Kenya was mismanaging its lions the way the Federal Wildlife Agency is mismanaging our lobos, there would be an international outcry. And if Spain had a war of elimination against its wolves and against the highly endangered Iberian lynx, there would be outrage all over the world. But the United States is now exterminating the lobo in the southwestern United States. And where is the outrage? Where is the international outcry? Indeed, where is the national outcry? It's an outrage going on now in Arizona and New Mexico for a handful of public lands ranchers, and it's being conducted by our federal government and by the political commissars that the Bush administration has put into the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. I want to encourage listeners to write your member of Congress and your United States senators to protest what has happened with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and to call on Congress to have oversight hearings on the Fish and Wildlife Service's war of extermination against the lobo in the southwestern United States.
Thank you, Dave. You can learn more about Dave Foreman and his work through the Rewilding Institute at rewilding.org. And finally, as always, Emma Sleeth brings her fresh youthful optimism to the stage. Emma?
Last week, in my History of Britain class, my professor was explaining how James II tried to flee from England when William of Orange was advancing on London. His face is on every coin in the country, Dr. McKinley reminds us. His statue is in every town square. He has decreed that he is monarch by the will of God and then made his views on divine monarchy official policy. His is a face every subject of the kingdom should know. Entering into the king's mind, Dr. McKinley mused, let me see. I'll take off my wig and dress in peasant garb, and no one will recognize me. We all laughed. Now class, he continued, that is roughly analogous to, say, Superman putting on glasses. Pulling on and off his own glasses to demonstrate, he sung, now I'm Superman, now I'm not. Now I'm Superman, now I'm not. Where is Superman? I'm not Superman, I'm Clark Kent. As I left class, I found myself still laughing, but the object of my laughter had switched from Superman to myself. I have made myself known as an environmentalist. I talk about creation care everywhere I go. And yet, do my actions live up to my standards? Or am I living a sham double life, not living out my words? Friends, with all due respect, who needs Clark Kent? Let's live the life we speak about every moment of our lives. Let's be Superman 24/7.
Okay, Superman I am, until next week, when we bring you again the Weekly Earth Summit. And now a special program note. If you'd like to add your voice to the Weekly Earth Summit, email me at wildsidenews@cox.net. Speaking of emails, I got an email from an ancient friend and new listener, otherwise known as Deborah, who sent me a link to a fantastic YouTube clip of Snowball, the Dancing Cockatoo. You have to take a look at this. It's fantastic. I put a link to the clip, which is actually posted on the Bird Lovers Only blog, and I want you to take just a moment and imagine Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. Here's the audio from the video. Be sure to watch, though. I don't know about you, but I know anytime I happen onto America's Funniest Pet Videos, I'm stuck. And what it says to me is, the animals are wildly smart. I saw a clip of a cat, this was just recently, unlocking and opening a sliding glass door. In this modern era, we're giving animals a lot of new challenges in cohabiting in close proximity to we humans in our homes and apartments. And with video, thank God, we are capturing the amazing ingenuity, creativity, passion, emotion, expression, and the phenomenal spirit of so many animals. We humans in the world are in a process of restructuring, trying to adapt to a whole new matrix of truth about ourselves and the living systems. And we all need to do everything we can to be sure that we build in a powerful awareness of the amazing intelligence and joy that individual animals have and share with us every day when we pay attention. Because when we do, we will all begin to build a better, more conscious world. So be sure to watch Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo. I laugh every time I see it. We now head on up to the real Midwest, to Rushford, Minnesota, where we've been following the story of recovery of this small town, hit hard by a major storm system that led to severe flooding. Let's see what's happening. Well, continuing the story from Rushford, Minnesota, the town in southern Minnesota that was so devastated, along with many of the other towns in southern Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa, by the floods of mid-August. It's a story about a community, 1,500 people, who suddenly found themselves in a crisis due to natural conditions, unusually heavy rains. And we've been kind of following this story with a local resident there, Donna Buckby, who we talked to literally the night that it was happening, and we've followed through ever since. Donna, I want to talk with you and see how things are progressing in Rushford, Minnesota. Welcome to the Wild Side News again.
Hi. Hello.
Well, it's been almost 2 months.
Yeah.
And the small town in Minnesota, why don't you just give me whatever comes to mind about what the status of this town's recovery is?
Well, everyone's in limbo right now. Well, for the most part, some people are rebuilding their homes. And, well, some people have just turned their backs and walked away without even mucking out their homes. Houses are coming down. There's big gaping holes around town. The houses are gone. But a lot of people are just in limbo. The businesses are in limbo, and people wanting to rebuild their homes are in limbo because of the struggle now between the legislature and the governor and the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which has taken over the doling out of the cash. Cash has not really arrived.
Any easy answer to as why it's not arriving at this point yet?
Well, there's a debate about how to interpret the legislative bill. But the legislature, as they wrote this bill, it was understood that the money was to be given to the local units as a grant and that they could decide to give this out how they saw fit. But then through the governor and the Department of Employment and Economic Development, they have taken over the doling out of the funds. And instead of granting the money, they are requiring loans.
Now, would this be on a community-wide basis or on an individual basis?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I understand, but it would be individual basis.
I mean, for example, if my home was devastated by a flood, would I be applying to the state grant, you know?
You're supposed to go through the small business agency to get this loan, and you might get, depending on the interest rate and the conditions met, like if you stayed in that location for 10 or 12 years, then maybe 50% of your loan will be forgivable. And then other people would have to pay back 75% or 80% of the loan. And that is the business community and the homeowners are saying that this will bankrupt the town. The way they had been given hope early on by our wonderful legislators that this money was going to be a grant. But the state is saying, well, we need to be fair to the rest of the state who have not been given grants during disasters. But Rushford is really kind of unique because this wasn't a tornado people could have had insurance for or other types of disasters that they could have had insurance for. This was a flood, and they aren't considered in a floodplain. And so they were discouraged from or even not allowed to. They weren't even given the option to have flood insurance.
You mentioned that you hadn't been down in Rushford for a couple of weeks.
Well, I haven't been down kind of working really hard down there. Actually, a tree fell on my house. There was a bad storm, and it's really hard to find carpenters who can come and help out here because they're all in town.
Wow.
So, I'm kind of waiting here, too. So I have my own priorities here at home, but I will be going down in Thursday to do some work. And we've been checking in and going to some fundraisers, and we're working on maybe getting the type of registry so people can buy building supplies, kind of like bridal registry.
One of the stories that we kept following was whether at what point the town food store would be up and running. Is that back up and running yet?
Well, you know, the shelves are up, and there's some dry goods on the shelves, and I think they're going to open in a week or so. It's really a gift. And the Hoynes family, they are really taking a big risk to open up again because they don't know what's going to happen to the town. But also, my understanding is that, okay, the owner of the grocery store lost the store, but he also lost his own home. So he had to put up as collateral his two other stores in other towns in the area, and also, I for sure, one of his son's homes and maybe two sons' homes. Hmm. Now, what if business isn't as fast or as good in the months and years ahead? What's going to happen? Everyone recognizes that this man is giving a huge gift to the community, that he's taking a huge risk.
Well, that is the way it is in rural parts of America. There is truly a community. Well, it sounds as if things aren't moving as probably as fast or as smoothly or as with the strength and vigor that people had hoped.
Right, right. They're very disappointed, they're heartbroken, and they're angry.
There are things about life I don't understand, one of them being that it seems as if in terms of these forms of sort of bureaucratic responses or whatever this is called, somehow don't take into account that there's actual real people who are involved, good people. These people didn't bring this on themselves. You were talking about, for example, a home loan. You know, in small towns, there's 87-year-old grandmas who basically have a fixed income. They've owned the home. Now the home is gone. Maybe they didn't have insurance. They don't have an option. Maybe there is an option, but that pretty much is the end of their saga in terms of their home.
That's right. That's right. They're moving in with their children, or they're moving into vacancies at the nursing home.
You have your electricity up and running and the water is back, or how are people dealing with that?
Oh, the water. Well, the electricity is on in most of, a lot of the town. Water is back. People, they say you can drink the water, but I'm having my well tested. I live 6 miles out of town because of the concentration of atrazine and other chemicals that went into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
We're all afraid here. But what one of the things that the town discovered when they were pulling these houses down and lifting cement slabs up, that there are over 200 uncapped wells in town. So all that flood soup went down into those open wells.
Oh, that is that's a bad story.
It's a real bad story.
Towns like that rely on wells.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they spent weeks flushing out the city wells,
yeah.
And they had to just keep pouring chlorine down them and keep flushing them out. So I don't know what's going to happen with the drinking water here.
Mm. Now, how about things like in many homes there, I imagine good old-fashioned heating oil is the way people stay warm. People do have to stay warm. Have you had some cold spells yet?
Well, yeah, there have been some cold snaps here, but most of the people, the homes are totally open and gutted, and so no one's living in them. They're staying somewhere else.
Oh, really?
People are panicking because they want to get their homes closed in before the snow comes.
They've got about a week or two.
Well, yeah, I mean, it could happen any time. And, people are really afraid about it. They want to get their homes at least closed in so that they can get heaters in there.
Well, just between you and me, I don't think it's going to happen. I've built a house. I know how long it takes. And particularly if you don't have help, I mean lots of help, you're not going to get that done. And the supplies and then the economics, this doesn't sound very good.
No, it doesn't. We're all really scared.
So what are you going to do about that? How does a person handle that? We're talking about a Midwestern town. There is no more Midwestern than southern Minnesota.
Right.
What's happening to these people? I just, it's hard for me to fathom.
Well, I saw this kind of psychological chart about what happens, and I'm kind of feeling it. Immediately afterward, there's such community cohesion that people are almost elated, especially because no one was killed in Rushford. Although the stories I've heard, it's just amazing that no one was killed. But now, because of this state of limbo and the money not coming and winter coming on, people are getting depressed. And you just, some people are just working right through it, but others are just, well, they're almost, the town feels like it's, some of it is stagnating. I'll tell you, but when that grocery store opens up, that's going to be huge.
Sure it will be.
Yeah. But it's just very depressing right now.
Yeah, it'll be a psychological anchor for people, and they'll feel a sense of stability, and that something is moving along. Well, I heard about this story. That's why I was curious about this. What does happen to a community of 1,500 that is devastated by a flood? Good Midwestern folks, a farm community. One could hope that things went better. I truly imagined and hoped that they would. But based on what you're telling me, it sounds as if this is, you know, becoming, yet we've talked about this before, but this kind of is following the Katrina pattern. Not that it's the same. I don't know that there's people absolutely can't move at all because they can't get the funding. But it just seems as if there's a lack of some sort of unified response that meets the challenge of this community.
Right. I don't understand that either. Why wouldn't we just be able to have if we had to buy insurance then just to cover anything, a flood, fire, tornado, vandalism? Why couldn't we just get that coverage? I don't understand that. Or maybe just that one time in our lives we'd have our homes replaced if there was a catastrophic disaster. But no, I can't understand it myself. Why can't we get this going here? I know our taxes are going to go up. That's fine. It's a privilege to pay taxes. I'm not opposed to that. But to fix the roads, Sydney, the roads in Houston County have been devastated.
You mean because the floods took out pavement and cut through roads and that type of thing?
Yeah, they wiped out a lot of bridges. Houston County has more bridges than any other county in the state.
Hmm.
And so bridges were lost and roads were washed away, and there were a lot of mudslides.
Wow.
It took whole hillsides down over the roads.
Well, Donna Buckby, I had hoped really, truly, that this would be, that there'd be a sense that things are moving along and getting prepared for, I know what winter's like in that part. It isn't fun.
No.
As a matter of fact, you die if you're not prepared. You guys are in a tough state. I hate to say it. You mentioned that you heard some tales of dealing with that flood, you know, since we last talked. Mm-hmm. Any that you care to share?
Well, I met this one woman, this sweet young woman, last fall when we were going door to door for the elections. And I ran into her at a meeting a couple weeks ago, a Habitat for Humanity meeting. Town. And I went up to her after and I said, "Remember me?" And I said, "I definitely remember you and your dear children." And I said, "How did you fare in the flood?" And her face just totally changed. Her eyes got real big and she said that they heard the sirens and then they didn't know what to make of that. And then they heard the bullhorns and people screaming to go to high ground immediately, get out of your homes, get out. And she said, well, she lived in this apartment building. She said the people next door to her left 2 minutes earlier than she did, and they were actually able to get in their cars and drive away. But she said by the time she and her children went out into the hallway, she said it was so eerie, the light was still on, but water was coming up the hallway, first an inch deep, and by the time they got to the front door, it was up to their waist, and by the time they got outside, it was up to their necks in the pouring rain, the dark, and she said there was current and it was swirling and debris, and some of the neighbors on the other side of her were carrying their tiny little infant. And so these people tried to, they were bobbing up and down in the water and trying to find their way to Vinegar Hill. And she said they finally made it to the Vinegar Hill Road, which is a couple blocks away, and they sat there for 5 hours in the rain until someone came in a boat to get them. But it's just, these stories are repeated hundreds of times for this little town, and so people are really traumatized. It's just amazing to think about what they've been through.
That is truly a nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 They're really in a state of trauma. So they really need help. I mean, they need the money. And I don't understand why. I'm about to cry right now thinking about it. I don't understand why they can't get this money.
I guess it's the state of the world right now. It's as if the problems are so bogged down in some sense that things have to be controlled and run through systems that it doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't work. These people just need help. You know, it's like too bad we don't have a National Guard that's available. That you know, quite honestly, where's the National Guard? Or maybe I shouldn't ask that question.
Well, they were certainly here right after the flood, and thank God for them because they were very helpful. But here's another little kink in the story, is that the man who was appointed, maybe this doesn't have anything to do with it, but the man who was appointed to dole out the money by the governor's office ran for the legislature last fall, and he was not elected. And I'm just hoping that he's not punishing Rushford for not electing. I don't know.
Are other towns faring better than Rushford?
You know, I've been so tapped into Rushford, and I don't know about the other towns. I think if the money isn't here, it isn't in the other places either.
How about FEMA?
Well, the people, in order to get the FEMA money, they have to apply for through the small business agency for loans. And but I think they just have to apply, but then the FEMA will give them 28,000 max. And not everyone's going to get the maximum, but you can hardly haul the trash away for that. You can hardly demolish what needs to be demolished with that amount of money, let alone then to buy new building material.
So there aren't FEMA people on the ground there necessarily?
No, there are FEMA people, and the FEMA trailers. There's a trailer park. There are about 60 trailer homes right now, FEMA trailers. I mean, so FEMA is here.
Okay, good.
Yeah, but business cannot use FEMA. Homeowners can.
Uh-huh. So there are trailers. Well, that's at least good. There's at least trailers there.
Yeah, yeah.
How big are they? 35 foot or, you know, the single trailers come in many sizes. Are they house? Are they more like a long house trailers or are they more like travel trailers?
No, they look like the long house trailers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are they hooked up and ready to go?
I think they're working on that.
Well, that's a good sign.
I don't know if there are some blocks that are ready and people moving in. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah.
But they are putting the plumbing in.
Well, that's a good sign. At least it means that there's shelter.
Yeah.
Or potentially shelter. And that's the good news.
Yeah.
That at least someone is doing something. Otherwise, the picture was almost as if there was nothing happening. Well, Donna Buckby, is there anything else you want to share at this point about...
Well, just to remind people, if they want to donate to the Rushford Flood Disaster Fund, that they can send it to the City Hall in Rushford, Minnesota, 55971.
If people have stuff, I mean, do people need furniture and clothing?
There have been donations of furniture and clothing, and I think they're holding off with that now because they've got probably too much. Now, see, there is a good thing.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's what I want to find is the story here, because we learn from these things.
Right.
Learn to prepare, number one, but also we learn how to make things better next time it happens, and it's going to happen again. Somewhere, you know, it just happened to be your time.
Yes.
Well, Donna, thanks so much. I know that you're busy. You've got, of all things, a tree. What, a lightning strike that took that?
There was a horrible wind. People have. I was out of town actually. I was in western Minnesota, and. People called and said, well, the worst wind we've ever seen, except once, came and a tree is on our house.
Oh, my.
Yes. So the tree is cut off and it's off, but, I mean, the house has some damage, so it's not that bad. And really, I mean, compared to what everyone else is going through, it's absolutely nothing.
Well, Donna, I'll tell you what. I've got a spare bedroom here. If you need to just get away for a little while, you come on down.
Yeah, well, that's very sweet of you. And likewise, if you come this way, we have room, too.
Okay. Donna Buckby talking to us from Rushford, Minnesota, trying to deal with the flood that hit a couple of months ago. Thanks so much, Donna. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Sydney.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
I call it global weirding, as parts of our nation are flooding while others are drying up. When we return, we have a special Nature News segment about the dramatic drought that has people in the southeastern U.S. choking on questions of how they may be forced to cope in the very near future. And following that, ever wanted to write about nature? To become part of the emerging teams of journalists and writers who travel and report on and tell the stories of this changing earth? Stay tuned and you'll get a great briefing on what it takes from nature and environmental writer Wendy Holtkamp when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
The suns that fill the sky, I wonder if.
someone in the heavens looking back down on me. I'll never know. So much space to release.